This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and I'm getting an MRI done to find out if I'm claustrophobic. My co-host is John Pass, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and thinks the shovel was truly a groundbreaking invention. Learning a language is much more than learning vocabulary. Learning to anticipate interactions within a cultural context is a skill we're going to talk about to help you maximize your gains. Interviews with Elisa Ferrero, a native of Italy who learned English to learn Chinese and today is a Chinese teacher to Spanish speakers in Argentina. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey everybody, I'm John Pasden. I am in Shanghai, China, still on lockdown.
How's that going for you, John?
Every day is the same. It's not great, but we're okay.
Delightful. Well, maybe sometime this fall, they'll let you out of your apartment.
Maybe. Keep podcasting, I guess.
Okay, before we kick into our topic today, we do have a review. This was via email from Mike Kennedy, and he says, I just want to reach out and say that I've recently been doing some deep diving into L2 language acquisition research myself and have personally read several of the PaulNation papers you and John mentioned on the podcast. Really interesting stuff. It was interesting to read his paper where he replaced the English with nonsense words to simulate different recognition percentages. It was cool seeing that, having already seen the equivalent Chinese character version that you had made and presented at a conference. I also read another in which Stephen Krashen referenced research where learners were able to acquire the slang words from Clockwork Orange without a glossary. Very interesting. Thanks for bringing attention to this research and your show. Having said that, reading some of the research myself recently gave me an even greater appreciation than I already had for the method you use at Mandarin Companion to publish graded readers backed by research to the greatest extent possible. Awesome work. Keep it up. Thanks, Mike Kennedy, who is also the CEO of Jinbu Pal. So it's kind of a flashcard app. So thanks, Mike. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Mike. It's cool that you got into all that research. You know, Krashen is classic, PaulNation, all good stuff. Thanks a lot. All right, so today we've got a topic that's related to all language learners that are shooting for fluency. And, you know, it's not just like vocabulary, grammar, one of these things. What we're talking about is one of the mental aspects that you have to deal with when you're trying to build fluency. Because language is more than just, you know, memorizing a bunch of stuff. It's also a kind of familiarity. And so what we're going to talk about today is the role of anticipation.
I just can't wait for this, John.
All right, that's not the kind of anticipation we're talking about. We're not talking about like being so excited or like you're really looking forward to it. Like not that kind of anticipation. Like it's cool if you feel that way about, you know, every word that comes out of some Chinese person's mouth, that's fine. But we're talking about like knowing what to expect. Like you think you know kind of what they're going to say.
Well, that describes me and you. Like I'm just waiting for every word that comes out of your mouth and in excited anticipation, but you keep me guessing all the time, John.
Well, that's the guessing part. That's what we're talking about today. So let's just give some simple examples. Like if you're a student in a traditional classroom, then like what a lot of the Chinese teachers will do, any language teacher will do, is they'll make sure that you know some classroom Chinese. And when you hear something, you know what you're supposed to do. You know, when the teacher opens the book, you know she's going to tell you the page number or whatever. So when you get familiar with these actions and the language that is associated with them, then you start getting familiar with the whole communication game, right? It's not just words. It's interacting with the person and being familiar with that process.
But John, is this, excuse me, fluency. Sorry, I try not to use the F word. But is this what you're talking about?
All right. So in the context of a classroom as a beginner, then that doesn't really feel like fluency, does it? It feels like you're just, you know, conditioned response, nothing very impressive, but it's the beginnings of the familiarity with the language. So if you want to extend that into like interactions and in social situations in real life, then you also need to have some kind of expectations for what other people are going to say. For example, if you're going to be shopping in China, then you need to know like what to expect if it's a haggling situation, like what might they say? or if you start asking where stuff is or what the price is, like what words are they going to use? What structures are they going to use? You kind of need to be clued in on how this interaction works.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that this goes back to one of the really important things relating to comprehensible input, and that's having context. You know, so it's one thing to go memorize a whole bunch of flashcards. It's another thing to be able to use them in the proper context. And as we're talking about here, using that context to be able to anticipate what's going to be said, and even if you get a response that you don't understand based on the context, you know, and visual cues and body language, you probably can anticipate what they meant.
Right. And a good example of that, I think, would be a situation that a lot of us have been in, which is like a taxi ride, right? And in China, taxi drivers are often pretty talkative, and they tend to kind of ask the same questions, which in the beginning, the questions they ask are exciting and you're nervous and you're not really sure what they're going to say. But after, you know, 20 times and it's the same every time, you start to get comfortable with it.
Yes, that's I'm very good at these questions. You know, where are you from? How old are you? Are you married? What's your job? And how much money do you make? Those types of questions, right?
Right, exactly. And in the beginning, it's interesting. And then a lot of people, they feel like, oh, it's so boring. They always ask the same questions. But that boringness is something that native speakers go through too. And it's just part of getting familiar with the language. And Jared, I think we've both seen this one, I guess you could say kind of a meme. Anyway, it's this picture of this guy wearing this shirt that he wore in China, numbered 1 through 5, and it's the answers to the 5 questions he always gets wherever he goes and talks to random people.
And pretty much most foreigners get anywhere they go in China, or Taiwan for that matter. But yes, it's what the responses are, to where he's from, how old he is, you know, why is he in China, how long has he been here, and is he married?
Yep. And if you've been here and you've been in the same situation as this guy, when you see the shirt, even though he doesn't list the questions, you know what all the questions are. So that's the kind of familiarity, the anticipation that you're building as part of the fluency that you're developing.
One thing I think is really helpful when you start encountering these situations and, you know, you start getting to be able to handle these better is that, you, John, you mentioned this, that sometimes people think, oh, it's just repetitive, right? You know, if you're in a taxi, but, you know, a lot of people maybe not have that opportunity to, you know, go to China and do that, but they might talk to some Chinese person. And so they might ask those common questions like, oh, how'd you learn Chinese? You know, why are you studying these types of things? And maybe you're getting very comfortable at giving those standard responses, but this gives you that opportunity as well to now start elaborating a little more. You can prepare for these because, I mean, these are like questions you're going to get all the time, standard responses. So, you know, this is time to pack in a different way of saying something, to pack in maybe a new grammar element you're trying to learn or some new words, things like that.
Right, because you know these questions are coming, so you can definitely prep for them. And then there's all kinds of other situations where you kind of know what to expect, and so you can prepare for that. If it's familiar, great. But if it's not familiar and you know it's coming, then you can definitely prepare, have a better conversation, and extend your ability to communicate that much more with every interaction.
Definitely. So this is, I would say this aspect is a little bit like a teacher that, you know, worked with, Diane Neubauer. She talks about pre-teaching in relation to like our graded readers. You know, she will teach the class, you know, go through the book, find out what things that, you know, the class hasn't been taught yet or they're not likely to know, and start pre-teaching that for a couple months and before they go into jumping into a book. I think it's the same concept here of, you know, like, hey, pre-learn when you're coming to these situations. So get familiar with it so you're able to function better in this type of situation.
Right. And the more you can anticipate, then the better you can kind of pre-learn, you can prep for that interaction. Like if you have no idea what they're going to say, then it's a bit harder. But, you know, whether you're going to do an interview in Chinese and it's in a certain industry where certain questions are always expected, or whether you're going to buy something and you know you need to ask for something and ask a few questions so you can prepare those questions. But then you can also anticipate what might happen when you ask certain questions and then prepare for what they might say after that. So, you know, this anticipation really helps you. And then when it does happen, you've actually rehearsed it mentally. You've looked at some of these words and it just goes so much more smoothly.
You know, John, this relates to something I recently encountered. I was doing an assessment from a company. They do language proficiency assessments. And in that assessment, And in that assessment, they gave a text that was from like supposed to be on like at a train station in China. And they're packed into this. There was some cultural knowledge that helped me be able to do better on this test. I think the question was actually a little biased, simply because I understood that there are certain places, if as a foreigner in China, you're supposed to buy your tickets at a specific window. And then there's other windows for if you're not a foreigner. And so simply understanding that helped me actually do better on this part of the assessment because I understood that. And I thought that question was a little biased. But there are some situations like that where cultural knowledge will help you interpret that language a little better and succeed.
Yeah, I've had that same experience recently, like related to like COVID tests or health QR codes or whatever. Like there's this form you have to fill out and it's really long, but you know somewhere in that form is the drop down where it's like ID card or passport. And so you have to find the drop down that says ID card, find it first. And then if there's no passport in there, then you can't use this form. So don't fill out everything else. Just find that one first. So again, that anticipation, that knowing what to expect is super important for navigating a foreign culture in that language.
And so like, how do you get that knowledge, right?
Pain, a lot of pain.
Pain. There's definitely that type of stuff in the language that just comes with experience. And, you know, you may not have that opportunity to be in China, especially right now under the current situation. But as you just try to immerse yourself a little bit more, you sometimes might pick up these things if you're watching a Chinese movie or a show, watching different videos, maybe from a tutor. You're just, if you get a little curious about some of the differences in culture and how things are done in different countries, then sometimes over time you start to pick up some of these things.
Yeah, and a lot of it is like little kind of subtle things. Like one thing you might notice if you've been in China long enough is like when Chinese people go to a shop and they buy something, they don't usually say thank you. Sometimes they do, but they often don't. And I remember thinking originally that, oh, that's so rude. People don't say thank you. I'm always going to say thank you. I was raised to be a polite guy, you know? But if you talk to Chinese people about this, usually their attitude is like, oh, well, yeah, you can say thank you, but they're just doing their job. So like, you don't have to. It's not a big deal. They're not going to be offended or think you're a bad person if you don't say thank you. And so if you're ever in a situation where you're doing some kind of service for Chinese people and they don't say thank you and then you're offended, well, again, that's like a cultural thing where you didn't know what you should expect. And as a result, you're kind of suffering a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's a lot of little cultural aspects like that.
It's funny, Jared, you know, way back in, let me check this. This was back in podcast number 21 years ago. How important is Chinese culture when learning Chinese? You remember what we said?
Well, I know my stance on this one. I think I probably said the same thing on that podcast. But what do we say, John?
We're like, oh, it's important, but it's not that important. Like, you don't have to be an expert on culture to, you know, learn Chinese.
It's true. It's true.
But I think what we're getting at today is a lot of this context is cultural, right? And to be able to anticipate what's going to happen is often a very cultural thing. So it's not like you won't survive without this stuff. But to get really fluent in Chinese means also being fluent in the culture, which helps you know what to expect from people because you can't really separate the language from the culture and how people respond to what you're saying to them, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, just to reiterate what, you know, my view on this is that, you don't need to know the culture to learn the language. But if you don't learn anything about the culture, it's going to present some of these challenges that we are talking about. And so, yeah, it's kind of like you don't have to, but it definitely enhances your ability to communicate. It enhances your ability to be able to relate to people. And on that same note, John, I remember recently my kids they're in plays, and I've been helping out a little bit with these. And I was working with one of the girls that was acting this play, and she was helping her try to get into character a little bit. And she was having a little bit of a difficult time. And so I said, hey, let's pretend for a second you're an alligator, all right? And if I come up to you, you know, you're an alligator. Okay, now I come up to you, what are you going to try to do to me? And she's like, I'm going to try to bite you. I'm like, that's right, because an alligator behaves in a certain way. And they will always try to bite you if they feel threatened or, you know, see you as a meal or whatever. And you know, and if if I come up and, you know, wrestle the alligator, it's going to try to roll around and all that stuff. So you can anticipate that. You know how an alligator is going to behave. And you can do the same thing for, like, maybe a tiger, you know, a cow, a lot of different animals, because they're programmed to behave in a certain way. To a degree, culture also, you know, programs us to behave in certain ways in certain situations. So just like being able to anticipate, you know, expect the behavior of something, that is, you can do that same thing in Chinese. Is that, you know, Chinese culture, the more you understand it, the better you're going to be able to anticipate how that person may react, or how they be able better to interpret how they are acting in certain situations.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there, Jared, because, you know, I come from Florida, and I went sea kayaking through the Everglades, and when you come across a gator, they don't bite you. They just go underwater and swim away.
Well, yeah, except for your friend that got dragged under and you never saw him. But no. Okay, you're right. Okay, maybe I don't understand. There you go. This is a good example. I don't understand alligators that way.
Yeah, fortunately, right? There wasn't so much pain involved in learning this about alligators. But yeah, okay, I get what you're saying. And actually, I want to give one more example to support this. And I think this might be something that you've experienced too, Jared. So when you first start living in China and you're maybe talking to people like the guards at your gate where you live, or, you know, people in your neighborhood, then how are they going to greet you? They frequently don't say ni hao. They're like, ni chi guo le ma, ni chi fan le ma, right? Have you eaten? And I remember, even though I learned that in my textbook or whatever, when people first started saying it to me, it's like, what are they asking me? Have I eaten? Oh, yeah, have I eaten? Well, have I eaten? And I'm like thinking about this. And it's like, well, I didn't have a very big lunch. Does that count? I guess I'll tell them. So you go through this whole thing. But then eventually you're just like, oh, yeah, they're going to ask me if I've eaten. Yeah, I've eaten. Have you eaten? Yeah, you've eaten. And like, you don't really think about it anymore. So this type of cultural experience and knowing what to expect makes it a lot easier, because I honestly used to have all this, like, I would think way too much about whether or not I had eaten every time I had this exchange. It was slightly painful in that way.
It'd be like someone asking you, what is up, right? And then, so you're actually looking above you and be like, maybe there's something on the ceiling up here. You know, I mean, no, that's not what we're asking, right?
Yeah, and a little tip for you, you don't really have to tell them if you haven't eaten. You can just say you've eaten. No one's going to mind.
Chill out.
Okay, so to sum up what we've been talking about today, this whole idea of anticipation, like knowing what people are going to say, is a part of fluency. And the more practice you get in Chinese, the more you're going to build it. But it's also something you can kind of focus on a little bit by prepping for interactions you're going to have and just kind of paying attention to the cultural context around the interactions you have. So sure, learn the vocabulary, learn the grammar, but just think a little bit about your interactions, and this anticipation will really help you improve your fluency in every interaction.
So, John, ni chi fan le ma? All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
All Set Learning Online Courses.
All right, John, this is some pretty cool stuff that you guys are offering.
All right, so a lot of people that know about All Set Learning know about the Chinese Grammar Wiki. And we have courses that hook into the Chinese Grammar Wiki. And, you know, grammar, oh, you don't have to study it. Oh, it's boring. Yeah, but you actually do have to practice speaking. And so these courses are all about practicing speaking, having real conversations, but you're getting support and trying to use that grammar and getting the corrections as you're trying to use that grammar.
Well, John, where can I find more information about this?
So if you go to allsetlearning.com/courses, you'll see a bunch there, including the grammar ones. And today, actually, we have a special discount code. So this is just for people that listen to this podcast. We've actually never done this before. But you can get a 10% discount if, when you purchase a course, 10% discount if you use the code You Can Learn Chinese, one word. So this is for first-time customers of our online courses, and we are happy to offer this 10% discount for You Can Learn Chinese podcast listeners. Come on over, give it a try, practice that Chinese.
So everyone, rush right now to allsetlearning.com. And remember, You Can Learn Chinese, promo code 10% off. All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rave. I am feeling positive.
All right.
So when I do these rants and raves, I try not to talk about the lockdown too much because that is my whole life right now. But I want to give a little rave for Taiwan, because Taiwan is fairly open right now. Like, if you're learning Chinese and you want to go to a Chinese-speaking environment and you can't get into the PRC, you actually can get into Taiwan. And I found out something recently that Taiwan, a lot of programs there actually offer simplified characters. It's kind of sad, you know, traditional characters, they're kind of losing this long-term battle. They're never going to go away completely, but fewer and fewer people are learning traditional characters as their, you know, their go-to set of characters. If you do want to learn them, you should definitely go to Taiwan, but Taiwan is awesome anyway. And even if you have no interest in traditional characters, you can go to Taiwan, live there, speak Chinese every day, and study simplified characters. I can't give you details, but I know it's possible.
Yeah, definitely. That's really good advice. So there's a lot of, this is something I've been talking to a lot of people about, John, is that just there's a lot of people who aren't maybe getting hooked on Chinese because they're not traveling to China and they're missing out on a lot of those experiences. But you're right, Taiwan, hey, that's a place to go right now.
And Taiwan is really cool. I've only been there once, but I really want to go back. It's the people are so nice. They have that charming Taiwanese accent. It's a fun place.
Definitely is. I think first time I was there, it was just so tropical a little bit. It was just beautiful, lush. And yeah, people were just wonderful.
Okay, so Jared, rant or rave for you?
All right, today I have a rave. That's right, I have a rave. And this is something I ran across recently on Reddit. It is, it's a website called hsklevel.com. It was pretty cool. Some guys developed this. You can just take this little, they say it's a test, I think it's a little more like an assessment, and it just throws a whole bunch of flashcards up to you. And I think it's computer adaptive, and it has a little bit of AI built into it, well, machine learning, really. And after going through, I think, about 50 characters, it's supposed to kind of give you like your HSK level assessment. And so I took it, and I'm like, hey, you know, I think that was pretty good. It was pretty interesting. So it's kind of like it's samples. It's based on statistical sampling, you know, of different words throughout the HSK levels to be able to try to assess what kind of level you're at.
So you saw words from all different levels?
Pretty much, yeah. And so it kind of pegged me, yeah, just around the HSK 5 level, so which is good. See, hey, there you go. I'm not HSK 6, John.
There's no shame in that, Jared.
There's no shame at all.
My last name is Ferrero, like Italian chocolate, but anyone knows me as Elisa Lao Shi.
Elisa and I met on Instagram, where she talks about learning Chinese specifically for Spanish speakers.
I work as a Chinese teacher. I've lived 10 years in Beijing. Now I live in Argentina. My work is teaching Chinese, 100%.
And as she said, Elisa is 100% committed to teaching Chinese, and she's pretty good at it too. I think you'll enjoy her story just as much as I did. Stay with us. Elisa, why did you start learning Chinese?
When I decided to learn Chinese, I was 19 years old, and it was the time when you have to choose which college, university you'll go to. I was sure I was going to do languages. I already spoke English, French, and a bit of Spanish and German. And I was feeling like I didn't really want to end up with a degree or like a piece of paper which said I can speak Spanish, you know what I mean. So I thought if I wanted to do languages, at least it should be a language either very difficult or that a few people knew at the time. It was the late 90s. One day I heard a friend saying that in the company her father was working for, they had an interpreter of Japanese.
Mm.
And she said, you know what? They pay him a fortune. And yeah, okay, I was already thinking about that. And I must be honest, at that moment, I said like, oh, okay, yeah, there's that too, because I have to think about my future too. So it was 1997, and everyone in Europe was talking about the languages of the future. And that's where Chinese came into the picture. This thing about Japanese really made me think more about the different language. So it was something like having to flip a coin between Chinese and Japanese, because I didn't really know anything about China or Japan. So I didn't flip a coin. What I thought was like two things. One, I thought Japan is economically and technologically more advanced than China. So maybe more people already speak in Japanese. That's what I thought. I didn't even really know. Second thing I thought was, as far as I knew, Japanese people generally spoke better English than the Chinese people. Maybe there was much more need of people speaking Chinese than Japanese. So maybe I'll have more possibility to grow professionally. I didn't really know a thing about Chinese or Japanese culture. I didn't even know Chinese has no alphabet. I mean, I didn't know anything.
Wow.
I just saw it like this big territory where everything was to explore yet, and I felt fascinated. So I still remember my parents' reaction when I went home one day and I said, hey, I'm going to learn Chinese. I mean, I grew up in a small town in Italy, so you can imagine there were not many people learning Chinese in 1997. But
yeah.
That was 25 years ago, and here I am, happy with my choice.
Wow. Tell me a little bit more about this here, because at that stage, you had already learned, you know, some English, Spanish.
Yeah, French and a little German.
But you were already living in a small town in Italy. So how was that experience now contrasting a little bit to like starting out, hey, I want to start learning Chinese?
I'm from Piemonte, which is a region of the northwestern part of Italy, so close to France. So many people studied French. And in the high school, I studied English, French, and German. And then when I finally began university college, I studied Chinese and Spanish. Languages it's something that was always in my head from middle school.
So how did you go about this? Like, okay, mom, dad, I want to learn Chinese. What happened? What did you do?
I went to Turin and I went to university. And the degree I chose was foreign languages and literature. And of course, we have to choose two languages at the time. One was like the main one, and in my case, it was Chinese. Second one was Spanish. My first experience of learning Chinese, because I had several, was at university in Italy.
Your first experience of several was at university. So tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I learned Chinese at university in Italy 5 years, and then I went to China several times, and I had different study experience, because the first time I went to China was 1999, beginning of my second university year, and I went to Beijing Language and Culture University. I went together with 20 schoolmates. We were living in campus, and we took a 3 months intensive Chinese course, traditional way. So when I say traditional approach, I mean pre-memorize a list of words, because you will need them tomorrow to read a text. You try to memorize it, like squeezing into your mind, like 20 to 30 new words per day. I'm not even talking characters, words per day. And I tried to squeeze them into my head, sometimes successfully, sometimes not that successfully. And the RTN, Zamashua, day after, you go to class and you have to use those words, but you haven't really acquired them. You know what I mean? So, like, first experiences have been a little bit frustrating. Just a little bit.
A little bit. Right. You know, at times like this, these are hard times, you know, of learning Chinese. And it sounds like even the situation that you were in was not optimal, if you will. So why did you keep going? Because, you know, I'm sure there were people dropped out of the program along the way, even after the first semester, stuff like that. What kind of kept you going and saying, like, I still want to keep pursuing this?
In some ways, like, I knew I could. I just needed to find that click or find that something. Many people quit. It's absolutely true. When we began, we were like 60 people in Chinese class. after 4 or 5 years, we were like 15. And actually, I thought about giving up. And the funny thing is that the first time someone talked about quitting, it was not me. It was my teacher. My teacher, first day of class, telling us why and who should eventually quit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The first day of class in university, first day, before even beginning the class, our teacher told us who should give up and why. She said that many people begin to study Chinese because it sounds, it looks cool, but then they have no idea what they will be facing, which is true. And at that time, as I told you, it was the 90s in Italy. We had basically no material written in Italian. So literature books were all in English. Dictionaries were in English.
Wow.
Dictionaries, because at that time, we were not so lucky as the people who study now. There was no internet in 1997.
It wasn't good back then.
No, yeah. It was painful.
Yes.
As an Italian, I couldn't find a decent dictionary because the only dictionaries, Italian, Chinese, Chinese, Italian, were this terrible like pocket edition. You know that?
Yeah.
So I had to buy like a 2-volume, I don't know how many kilograms it was, dictionary, Chinese and English. So actually, my teacher told us, you have to be aware that a lot of your study material will be in English, including dictionary. So if you don't know any English, you'd better quit today. Textbook, don't even get me starting on that. It was, yeah, we had a textbook in Italian, but it was a handwritten photocopied textbook topics from the 80s.
Like, oh my goodness.
The Communist Party. The party, oh. I mean, the words.
Very stimulating subject matter, right?
Yes. I mean, these words we have to remember, the Communist Party, the Party Comrade, the Revolution. And then, of course, I didn't know how to buy a toothbrush. So hilarious. But I can tell you when I thought I'm going to quit, because yeah, that happened too. At that time, my teacher told us, okay, the English thing didn't really scare me. I said, okay, my English is okay. And for the rest, I said, well, let's see how it goes. And I began. And after 2-3 years, there comes the time when I really, really think about quitting. I had already went to Beijing once, like 3 months staying. I had studied the grammar. I had filled tons of papers with strokes. And I was not able to speak. And I was like, okay, 1 year, maybe is okay. Chinese is difficult. Let's give myself some time. 2 years kind of started to bother me. 3 years, I went to China already. Why on earth I cannot speak? Like, okay, I could speak something, but I wanted more. So I was something between bored and frustrated. Like the philosophy Schopenhauer says, life constantly switches between pain and boredom. It was just reading examples from textbooks. In that way, when you just have to read the example and you kind of want to get over it, no? Because you don't want to, how do you say that in English? Like,
Lose face.
Lose face. Yeah, you don't want to lose face for not pronouncing well. And then the most interesting part is that I wouldn't even lose face with anyone because no one was going to listen to me because my classmates were also thinking about which sentence they were going to read and everyone looking for the pinyin and quickly annotated it above the sentence in order not to lose face themselves.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know.
It's just a class to try to keep up appearances, but not a lot was happening.
Exactly. Not a lot was happening. So, so boring. I mean, it felt like it was a big nonsense. And I feel frustrated because I have been studying for a certain amount of years and I cannot speak. It's like all the same. And I felt frustrated too, of course. Because, well, I'm not going to tell you anything new here. You just don't learn to speak that way.
Yeah, I talk about this sometimes. It's about the difference between knowledge and proficiency. You know, you can know a ton of the language, but that doesn't mean you're able to use it.
Exactly.
I had once someone describe it like, it's like if you read a book on how to play guitar, you could know everything about the guitar, but you don't practice. You know, you're not going to be able to play the guitar, right?
Exactly. So this kind of teaching methods, like, I'm not saying they don't teach you interesting things. Of course, everything is interesting about Chinese. If you let me, I can talk you for weeks about your origin of characters, about the radicals, about a lot of stuff, which is really interesting. But then it has to be clear what helps you speak, what helps you acquire the language, and what helps you know as you said, tones about the language, but really you don't use it. So at this regard, let me say the title of your podcast is so good, so simple and so good, because it really touches that pain point, that thing that every student is looking for. They want to learn Chinese, not how Chinese grammar works, or they want to learn Chinese. They want to learn to speak. And, you know, I didn't learn how to speak Chinese in class. And the sad thing I'm seeing now, it looks like not much has changed.
In some places, you're right. But Aliza, what changed for you? You know, you're going through this, you're bored, frustrated, but fast forward 20 years, look at you now. What happened?
So that's what happened to me. My third year of university, I said to myself, this time I'll go to China, but I'll not go into a campus. I had three classmates, frustrated like me, who wanted to do the same, like go to Beijing, live in Beijing, having to rent an apartment, make phone calls, having to do stuff alone outside the protected environment of the campus with no people speaking English to you. It was not easy, but I was lucky enough to have a friend who really liked to speak Chinese. She was not afraid of making mistakes or lose face, which I was. So she usually just go along and try to speak. And I was like behind her, you know, like trying to listen. That was a big help because it like pushed me a little bit, you know. And then I saw that, yeah, nothing bad was going to happen if I made a mistake. And most importantly, I began to see that I could understand Chinese people just a little bit more every day, a little bit more. And that's a relief. It's like you feel, okay, these people are talking to me and I am understanding what they say to me. And most importantly, because that's the most difficult part sometimes, Chinese people began to understand me when I was speaking Chinese.
Oh, that's delightful.
I started to feel that they could understand me and I could understand them. That was the click which made me decide, okay, I left everything and I moved to Beijing by myself. I applied to a small private school where I could study classes that I really liked. And I began to work after that as translator interpreter for an Italian company. And guess what? All of my workmates were Chinese. So you ask me, yeah, that's cool, sounds nice. I will have Italian workmates for sure. No, actually, no, they're all Chinese. I was the only, the only Italian in the office. And it's incredible how context helped me doing that process that my brain needed to do in order to start thinking in Chinese and not listening and trying to translate every single word in my head into my native language first. I still remember the day one of my colleagues, she was talking at the phone and someone was asking her to do, I don't know how many things at the same time. And at one point she stopped and she said, 我做不了,我忙不过来. And I still remember that moment I heard 我忙不过来. We all know the word for mang because we all studied in first on circle class in Chinese, but mang bu guo lai, it's like I cannot do all of this at the same time because I don't have enough time. Being like in immersion environment, that really, really, really helped me a lot. You just don't have time to think.
I think what you're highlighting in that story is that it's that tendency to always like kind of translate it and try to understand it in your native language. But at that point, it made sense to you in Chinese. And instead of saying, oh, I'm going to try to really pick this apart and translate it or something, I just understand it. I know what she's trying to say.
Totally new sensation, because in class, they don't train you to do that. And it's like students feel the need of knowing everything and why. I don't know if you ever taught Chinese class, but...
I've helped out with some Chinese classes, so...
Okay. Have you noticed that the why question is one that comes up frequently?
It's true, yeah.
Why? 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 Yeah, we want to know why. They feel like they lack something if they understand, but they don't know why. You have to understand that if you understood, it's okay. Your brain will do the rest. So for me, it was this emergency situation, like where I didn't have no choice, or when I had to go to the visa office to renew my visa after quitting the scholarship. That was an emergency situation. But I had years of studying Chinese behind me. So I really wouldn't suggest to anyone who is just starting you know, to just, mm-hmm. well, go to China, try to survive, or listen to Chinese radio or news, and then you will get used to it. No.
I'm on board with that because I know you're big on this too, is comprehensible input, something you can understand.
Exactly. If you don't receive comprehensible input, you don't comprehend it and you're not able to process it. I know people really who have lived in China 20 years and speak no Chinese, or really speak the same Chinese my students speak after 5 CI lessons. And that's not because I'm a genius. It's just because CI, comprehensible input, is the way to go because it helps your brain process things.
It's true because, you know, you want to jump into a movie or something or a TV show. Well, I always tell people this, if you're really motivated and you're really interested, that can carry you through a lot of the pain, you know. But for most people, yeah, you're not going to have access to much at the beginner stages.
This also has to do with people's personality, because sometimes if you are not afraid, if you know you will be exposed to tons of words you have no idea about, it's okay. If that doesn't scare you, it's okay. You maybe won't understand, but you are curious. You want to hear how the language sounds. It's okay. But don't expect any like benefit that will help me speak.
Yeah, especially at those early stages. What kind of changed for you though, Elisa? You're now a translator in Beijing at an Italian company. You're really starting to click here with the learning Chinese. What stage did you say, hey, I want to teach this language? And what even kept you in China? Like saying, hey, you spent 10 years there.
What kept me in China was this sensation. I was feeling that my language was improving and improving and improving and improving. And then on the other hand, life happens. You know, I got a job. I had tons of friends. I mean, I was happy in Beijing during some years. The last 2 years in Beijing, I did teacher's trainings in BLCU, you know, the same university where I had studied Chinese for the first time. Then I did, you know, the TCSOL program.
Yep.
Teaching Chinese to speakers of other languages. They train teachers to teach Chinese to speakers of other languages. So it's a L2 approach. Of course, traditional approach. I don't really use that methodologies, but there was a point when I really felt that my Chinese was improving because all the trainings were in Chinese. And 99.9% of the teachers were Chinese.
These are student teachers.
Exactly. So another very good experience, you know, to prove I could do it. I could speak Chinese. Maybe one day I could even teach. And that's what I do now.
Well, that's really neat. And you even mentioned about, you know, getting your teacher certification. You get these traditional methods. But what kind of like made that shift for you and saying, hey, I'm going to teach in a different way? And maybe you could explain a little bit of what is that change?
That just happened 3 years ago.
Oh, the grand scheme of your Chinese learning. This is very recent.
Yes, I've been teaching Chinese in Argentina for like 8 years now. First 5 years, traditional. I was given a textbook because that's what they use, and just go and teach. Of course, I always tried my best to make students speak, but I was falling all the time into this trap of explaining why. I mean, after a while, I began to question myself, like, how do I get these people to speak? Because why this keeps happening? I was like scrolling Instagram and I was looking to a profile of a teacher who teaches Chinese. I guess it's French or Spanish. I don't even remember. Uh-huh. And she talked about TPRS, like teaching proficiency through reading and storytelling. And that, you know, you see something and you say, oh, look, this is interesting. Like this can mm-hmm. be applied to any language. And from that moment, I start reading, never stopped. 2 years ago, maybe, I also attended a training with Terry Waltz, which you surely know.
Oh, I love Terry.
Yeah, everyone loves Terry.
You're talking about your story about you're going to study Japanese or Chinese. You thought maybe flipping a coin. Terry Waltz actually flipped a coin.
You got to be kidding me.
And it landed on Chinese. So that's why Terry Waltz is now in Chinese education. So
Okay. So I was about to flip a coin. I didn't really flip a coin. But
so you did Terry Waltz training. She's fantastic. Yeah. I love her. She's wonderful.
Yeah, that was like a couple of years ago. That day I saw that word, I saw TPRS, I said, what is this? And these people saying, you can teach using only stories, there is no need for teaching grammar. And it's like, what? That sounds fantastic. How do I do that?
I have an idea about this, but what did you start doing differently and how was that impacting your students?
Everything changed. Everything. I mean, it's a good question because there is a point when you read and read and read and think, okay, this makes sense. I mean, I want to do that. But how do I start? You know, reading in Chinese is not the same reading in Spanish or alphabetical languages. So I just started to make like puzzle. I started to write my own micro stories. I made a lot of like word walls and point with interrogative, with question words, like leading to speak from the day one. It means I create my own materials. Majority of CI teachers use activities like picture talks, like movie talks, like a lot. I do all that. I create my own readings, short, like one or two pages. It's something that at the beginning requires a lot of work, but you talked me about the impact. It's incredible because people don't believe that you can actually say a word in Chinese at the first class. I present the first piece of reading, only character, no pinyin, after five classes. I mean, any CI teacher can do that, really.
But you're right. If you're done right, it can work very well.
I can't believe how much Chinese we're speaking in class with X classes. So there aren't more teachers doing that because really, I don't know. Now I have textbooks I want to burn. And I still have them and I keep them because it's like a memory, you know, from my life in Beijing. When I moved to Argentina, I made like boxes of textbooks and it's like, I know, I treasure them because it's like memories. But really, I open them and now I say, how I was able to teach with that? I mean, I don't know. I don't, and I talk about anything else, but not textbook, topics of interest, only using CI strategies and making my own reading materials. And reading materials, you know stuff about it. So
a little bit.
Yeah. Grading. And that changes everything. And don't even get me started of the pleasure of reading in Chinese.
When you can understand it. And I think that's one of the cool things about Chinese is that a lot of times people think like, oh, you know, I might have to study 10, 20 years before I could read something in Chinese, like a book.
Well, actually, when I was in university and learned with traditional methods, I basically was provided with zero reading experience all through my university degree. Really, zero. Yeah. Because when I said reading, I mean extensive reading. I don't mean, I was reading sentences, but that's not reading actually, no?
It's very limited access, you know, to the language.
No, you don't get any input because at that time, sentences, the mu biao, the objective, is like teach you a grammar pattern. And si entonces, so they would find sentences which contains the grammar pattern, but are taken from a variety of different contexts. So you are exposed to a lot of words you don't know and not having a context, it's like, I don't know, everything dies there. You're not reading about anything. And you are in class and you are expected to read aloud. Mm. So you don't want to lose face. Reading in Chinese is looking at characters, understanding what they say. Point. Then reading aloud, reading Chinese is reading meaning, not necessarily sound. Of course, the ideal is I'm studying a language. I want to know meaning and sound. Okay, I got it. It's okay. It's perfect. And also, if you use comprehensible input in your classes, you know that I fill with their heads with comprehensible messages all the time. So they already have the sounds into their heads. You know, so when they face a reading, it's a reading piece about what we have talked about. So they have the sound. But even if they don't, reading is looking and understanding meaning. So you don't force yourself to read aloud because your teacher tells you. I give readings to my students and every CI teacher does that because we want them to read. And I didn't read anything. I think my first book I read in Chinese was To Live by Yu Hua. Because it's written in quite quite simple and overall understandable Chinese language. It's not the kind of, you know, literature which is so difficult, which I don't read even today. I mean, I can't be bothered to read that. It's too difficult, you know?
But that's the point, is that you always want to get to a point where, hey, I can read native materials, right? I mean, that is the goal. Graded reading materials are there to help you learn. There's a time where, hey, you're able to progress far enough in the language and say, hey, I'll take these training wheels off. I'm ready to actually do something native, authentic. That's the term, right? Authentic reading materials, right?
Yeah.
Well, Aliza, if you could go back and change one thing in your experience of learning Chinese, what would you have changed and why?
I mean, all this CI, comprehensible input stuff, it really like resonated to me so much. Because I was seeing like students struggling, but I also struggled. So I don't know, maybe if I hadn't struggled that much, I wouldn't be so passionate today about teaching with comprehensible input. Maybe it wouldn't be like this today. So I don't know if I'd change anything. The difficult thing is suggest. I mean, when people come to me and telling me, okay, if someone comes to me and say, I want to have class. Okay, welcome. I'll make you speak. But sometimes people also ask you for suggestions, like, what do you suggest me to do if I want to learn Chinese by myself?
So what advice would you give to someone like that?
Yeah, actually, that's a difficult moment when I have to reply to that messages, because it's like, I don't want to put you down. But I know how to make you speak Chinese. I don't know how do you get to speak Chinese by yourself. Honestly, if you have the possibility to try to look for a teacher who can make you speak, who can basically look for a CI teacher.
But self-learning.
Self-learning. I don't know anything about self-learning. That's the problem, because because I didn't learn by myself. And really, I know how to teach. But if you want to start from zero, I mean, look for help, look for a teacher. And well, of course, because sometimes I ask, what do you think it is, or what do you mean by basic Chinese? Because many people come to you and say, no, I just want to learn the basics. Okay, stop. What do you mean as basic? Guess what? What do they tell me? Yeah, you know, days of the weeks, colors, some vocabulary about a restaurant, blah, blah, blah. And I say, okay. And then I say, what do you do with that? I mean, basic Chinese is not learning words. And then you get me started and I start to speak like blah, 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 blah. Basic Chinese is knowing 7 verbs and starting from there. So, okay, I can, you know, but then it's difficult. I can tell you, it's not secret to any CI teachers what the super 7, we give credit to Terry for that too. I mean, there are some verbs that you always, always use. So, okay, start from that. But the problem is you cannot find material, you know, or just a little. You have to really know where to look. It's not like you open YouTube. Or maybe I would suggest open YouTube and look for comprehensible input Chinese. Okay, there I have the suggestions. That's the suggestion.
Good. Some suggestions there from a teacher who you're getting results with your students. That's really insightful. So, well, Aliza, I really want to thank you for taking the time to be on this podcast and sharing your story and your insights and collective experience with us. That's some of that's really hard-won experience, if you will. Aliza, if people want to find out more about you, where can they go?
They can open Instagram and look for Aliza Lao Shi, or open their browser and www.elizalaoshi.com. Not really original, but easy to remember.
That Aliza is E-L-I-S-A, so like Elisa. So,
all right. E-L-I-S-A, Lao Shi.
And we'll put a link in the show notes.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am a big fan of Mandarin Companion. I always suggest my students to buy your books. So, I mean, I really appreciate your work, guys. I love it. So, really, it was a pleasure for me. Thank you so much for having me.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, attendant, runner, camper, actor, drummer, critic, gamer, marine biologist, and that one gal named Sarah. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at MannerCompanion.com, or tag us on social media, #MannerCompanion. apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editors, Kaiser Guo at SubChina, and interview editors, Dominic Edgley. I'd like to thank our guest interview, Elisa Ferrero, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pastin. See you next time.